Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. So far, in Southern California, more than 420,000 acres have burned, nearly 1 million people have been reported evacuated, and more than 1,000 homes destroyed. This Lake Arrowhead man east of L.A. lost it all.
It was my home for 40 years, and now it's gone.
A perfect storm of drought and wind and sprawling development have caused this yet-to-be-controlled blaze to rage across the Golden State's Southland. Yesterday, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger called on Mother Nature.
We have to just pray that the wind goes away, because as soon as we have get rid of the wind, then the firefighters can really put an end to the fires all over the place.
Wildfire is as old as time in California. Bulging human populations are not. Not in Santa Ana wind country, and not in much of the American South, where from San Diego to Phoenix to Atlanta, it's been a tough, dry, thirsty year. This hour, On Point, wildfires in Southern California, the future of the California dream, and sustainability in the Sun Belt. Joining me first today from San Diego is Ed Joyce. He's an environmental reporter for KPBS, the local NPR affiliate in San Diego. Fire overran their transmitter yesterday, but Ed's still out there working. Ed Joyce, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be with you.
So is a corner being turned on this thing yet or not? Do you know?
No corner being turned, and that's really the bad news. The Santa Ana winds are dying down, but they're still windy conditions. Now they're more unpredictable, which makes things very difficult for firefighters trying to fight the fire, because they try to be in a defensible area to fight the fire, but the winds can shift now. When they were coming from one direction and steady, it was easier in some ways, although more, you know, disastrous for fire spread, but to fight that fire. Now things aren't calming down at all. It's looking worse, actually.
What's the best hope? What's the worst fear for San Diego here in terms of threatening population centers?
So many different things continue to shift. We've had one of the major fires merged with a newer fire. That fire is huge now, about 300,000 acres and growing throughout the county. They're trying to do backfires and protect some areas. It's just as they get a handle on some parts of these fires, something else pops up. There's another fire near Camp Pendleton that's blocking part of Interstate 5. That's about 5,000, 6,000 acres. These little fires keep spreading for various reasons, and it just doesn't make things easier for the firefighters.
Now, Ed, I'm looking at a map here of enormous fires burning all the way from up by Santa Clarita, nearly a couple hundred miles down to the Mexican border and all around San Diego. Why all these fires at the same time? Is there any connection, or is it just conditions being so susceptible?
Well, they have not released any causes of any fires. Initially, one of the fires was said to have been caused by an electrical transformer. Another fire, a house caught on fire in one rural community, and that spread and created a larger fire as well. They haven't released any causes for these fires as yet. The conditions were ripe for fire. We had been reporting for the last year. We had a very heavy rain year a few years ago, above average. That created a lot of extra growth. Then we had two dry years. It's been incredibly dry, record historic dry conditions throughout Southern California. The conditions were ripe. They got through the summer. But in Southern California, fire season is really year-round.
Fire season is year-round, and we read that it is growing, that temperatures have been a little bit warmer, and it's stretched out by another 70 or 80 days.
Yes, and they really have no idea when they're going to contain or control any of these fires. The best guesstimate at this point is at least a week from now. And to give you an idea of the temperatures, the fires make their own weather patterns as well and their wind conditions. On the beaches, this is late October going into November, the temperatures are in the mid-80s today, inland even higher in the 90s. So you can imagine those firefighters on the lines close to those fires in the inland valleys of Southern California, untenable conditions.
Now what about those beaches, the coast? I mean, there's plenty of development all over, but on the coast it is thick. Is that vulnerable in San Diego or on its wings? I mean, could this fire really get into the heart of the Southern California population?
Actually, it has already in some of the inland areas just off the coast. Some of the major suburbs in San Diego County have been scorched. There's been thousands of homes lost. It'll be probably in the billions by the time all is said and done when they get a chance to assess the damage. At one point, the fires were approaching the coastline. They were moving west. Those fires were coming from east to west, coming from the mountains, moving to the ocean. And officials had said these fires could spread all the way to the coastline, and some of them moved within miles. There were evacuations on parts of San Diego's coastline.
These population movements are epical at this point. I mean, LA Times is reporting over 900,000 now displaced. We've seen the pictures in San Diego, Qualcomm Stadium, and all over the place. Have you and other reporters at KPBS been out talking with them? And what lessons are San Diegans drawing from this? I mean, this is after another giant fire just, 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, just the Cedar Fire 4 years ago. This is far more disastrous and dramatic and heart-wrenching than even the Cedar Fire. The conditions, just so much dryness and so much more development and growth in the canyon areas. Some of these areas not really defensible. There have been environmental groups fighting some of these developments that are in fire-prone areas, but the developments have been allowed to go forward. The evacuees, their spirits are good. The outpouring of support, volunteers, sometimes the lines at some of these centers are longer for volunteers than those that are registering to check in to some of these evacuation centers. The outpouring of San Diegans of support has just been amazing. I talked to one 17-year-old who he and his family were evacuated, and to him it was, you know, as a youngster, it was a lesson not to take anything for granted, that everything can change in seconds.
But what about where people live and how they live? Do you think this will change Californians' attitudes toward living out in some of those valleys, change government attitudes on or developer attitudes on where they're going to put up new suburbs?
Well, there was conversations about that after the Cedar Fire 4 years ago in San Diego County. And since that time, there really hasn't been a lot of restrictions on some of these areas where they're fire prone. They rebuilt in all of those areas that burned 4 years ago. I guess the good news partly is that there's more defensible space around those areas. Defensible space meaning vegetation and other things that would block fire. So they have something called shelter in place where you can weather a fire in that area.
So maybe there will be change and maybe there won't. You were kind enough to point us to some tape from KPBS in San Diego. You all spoke, just an hour ago or so with California's Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein, and she talked about what fires can teach when it comes to new development in Southern California.
I believe after the Cedar Fire and after this fire, particularly for the San Diego area, there's a lesson learned in where you can build and where you shouldn't build, because of the consistent and what's going to be constant threat of wildfire in the area.
California Senator Dianne Feinstein, Ed Joyce in San Diego at KPBS, please stand by. I want to bring another voice into our conversation from Sacramento, California, out of harm's way at the moment. John Keeley joins us. He's an expert on wildfire and California ecology, research scientist with the USGS, U.S. Geological Survey, Western Ecological Research Center, also an adjunct professor in ecology and evolutionary biology at UCLA. John Keeley, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be here, Tom.
You note that there's a predicted 50% population growth in the next 30 years in California. The whole country, the world, is looking at what's going on there right now with the sort of jam-packed suburbs getting out into some of these valleys. This can look untenable from a distance. I mean, the fires of this size, we know they're natural. We know they've been there forever, but this population hasn't been, and it's supposed to grow enormously. Can California sustain this?
Well, I think that's probably the big question at this point in time. I think this is a good opportunity. The size of this event, coupled with the tremendous interest now in climate change and how we should be responding to climate change, I think this is an opportunity for us to look more broadly at all of the global changes that we're likely to be seeing in the foreseeable future. And certainly increased demography is one of them. And it's a critical matter, because the real problem with these fires has to do with the interaction between natural landscape fires and human development. And If we're going to see an expansion of development in Southern California, I think it's predictable that we're going to see more events like what we're seeing at the present.
35 million folks now, another 17 million maybe in the next 30 years. John, give us a sense of that interaction, of how it's changed, of how populated communities are pushing into areas where they haven't been, making them and perhaps the wild terrain itself more vulnerable to fire.
Well, I'll give you one example. The probably the biggest fire, or a fire certainly comparable to this event, occurred in the late 1800s. In 1889, there was a fire that, based on newspaper reports from numerous sources, it clearly was of the order of this particular fire event. However, there was perhaps nobody killed. It's not clear from the reports if anybody died in that fire. And there were essentially no homes lost in that fire. And it's clearly the difference is that we have grown tremendously in population since the late 1800s. We've moved out into landscapes where natural fires occur. And that's the big change. There hasn't been a change in the incidence, or at least the occurrence of large fire events, although they seem to be occurring more frequently today than we have reason to believe they did historically.
Ed Joyce, I mean, the pictures are just astounding. The emotional toll must be there as well. Do you sense a let's get right back to business as usual among San Diegans, let's say, as they deal with their losses here, or something else?
Something else. I think these fires are far from contained. New fires keep springing up in different areas for different reasons. Part of this, the larger fire spreading. Other things have been happening. All the schools in San Diego County are certainly closed for the rest of the week. More people are volunteering, I think, than probably going to work. The freeways aren't very busy. A lot of roads are closed. It's definitely not business as usual for the 3 million people in San Diego County.
We're talking this hour about wildfires in Southern California, the future of the California dream, and from Atlanta to Phoenix to San Diego, L.A., the rising issue of sustainability in the Sun Belt. Here's Ryan Hicks, a Rancho Santa Fe resident evacuated from her home.
The winds were so strong, and the timber in the land is so dry. It is history about how dry the land is. So it's like kindling out there.
We've been joined by San Diego's KPBS environmental reporter Ed Joyce in San Diego, and from Sacramento, California, by John Keeley with the U.S. Geological Survey, expert on wildfire and California ecology. Let's take a call right now from Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Thank you. You started the program by asking, is this situation sustainable?
Yeah.
And the answer is no, it's not, especially when you're building houses and putting in developments in areas that have very, very low water resources. And the second point that you brought up was, will it make a difference with contractors? And the answer again is no, because they're going to make their money and run, or else they're going to come back and rebuild after these disasters hit. And third, you have a situation where neither local state or federal government is going to say, look, these areas are not buildable, simply because you have a population at large totally out of touch with their environment who insist on having houses put there. There's a book out called Collapse, How Civilizations Choose to Succeed or Fail. I believe that's written by Jared Diamond, the same guy who wrote
Guns, Germs, and Steel. Yep.
Boy, should that be required reading, because I can just see now someone saying that couldn't possibly happen to us. Well, I think it's time we took another look at that book and got a feel for what we're doing, not just simply, by the way, in the South. What's happening in Massachusetts, for example?
Though it's not quite so dry there. Bill, you've got a lot on the table
yet already,
and I want to get a California response to it. First to you, Ed Joyce, what do you make of that perspective? That's from the opposite end of the country, where things aren't burning, but you hear all that skepticism about California's future growth path. Is that a voice you hear in your neck of the burning woods or not?
Oh, yes. There are several developments that have been proposed and go forward that environmental groups have fought for a number of reasons, including the fact that they're in canyons in non-defensible spaces in historic fire areas. They lose those battles most of the time, as you're seeing now with the fires throughout San Diego County and Southern California. The West in general, the Southwest, really is not for the most part, in an area that is supportable by natural resources. There isn't a lot of water. The Colorado River Basin is in the eighth year of a drought. Most of Southern California receives much of their water from outside the area. It comes from Northern California to south, and it comes from the Colorado River, which is in a drought. So we're already in problem areas with water as it is. So whether much of the Southwest can really support itself with the basic needs, including water, I would have to agree that there is a lot of opposition whether these areas are sustainable and can be built and supported with water and with these areas prone to fire.
And there's a big question on the table. I guess the other question is, though, whether anything actually gets done because the pressures are so great. The population growth is coming. People want to develop. Here's Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger speaking yesterday at Lake Arrowhead, California, east of Los Angeles, about the displaced residents there.
I've seen some of the homes here just now, and it's really sad when you see that. I mean, I'm heartbroken to see those kind of things because these are people that have saved their money for many, many years, and they finally got their home. They live in their homes, and then all of a sudden, you know, from one hour to the next, those homes are destroyed.
John Keeley in Sacramento, your governor is really sad and heartbroken, and that's easy to understand. But do you see a change in development policy in your state?
Well, I think if we don't see a change in policy, I think your Massachusetts caller is absolutely right. We're going to be seeing a future of even worse incidents. However, I see this as an opportunity for Southern California to alter the way they develop and reconsider thoughts on growth. The real problem when it comes to fires is the disconnect between local politics, state politics, and federal politics, because planning issues are really in the hands of local communities, mm-hmm. yet fire issues are state and federal issues, and there's been too much reliance on the state and federal government to solve these problems. It's a philosophy that there's an engineering solution to all our problems, but I think fire scientists and fire managers are beginning to recognize they're limited in what they can do under these sorts of conditions. And one of the bright spots I see is a Government Accounting Office report that was released last October in which they evaluated the expenditures of the U.S. Forest Service and pointed out that over half of their funds go to fire suppression activities, and the majority of those go to California, and most of that goes to protecting the wildland-urban interface. And they point out that the mandate of the Forest Service is to protect our resources and not to protect private property. And they suggested in that report that the Forest Service should look seriously at trying to recoup costs from local communities. I think if this sort of dialogue was conducted, I believe that communities would take more seriously these planning issues and produce a future that's going to be a lot brighter.
But maybe this is not recoupable, if that's a word. I mean, I'm looking here at a number that says more widely in the West, an estimated 8.6 million houses have been built since 1982 within 30 miles of a national forest. So you've got these communities just hugging right up against what can be tinderboxes, and reporting as well, Ed Joyce, that says you're getting hotter fires that move faster because of circumstances out there, whether the dryness and long-term slightly higher temperatures recently, and then just the burnable stuff that all those houses represent. Ed?
Yes. Well, the fuel is just there, and it has been for several years now. And a lot of these canyon areas, you know, the wind just whips through there, a fire starts, and it's off to the races, as you've seen in San Diego County. This has been a perfect storm just waiting to happen for several years, and it has. I worked in the Pacific Northwest for a number of years, and a couple decades ago there was discussions about edge forests. People were building in more rural areas outside the urban boundary, and they had some horrific fires in eastern Washington that brought this same issue up. Should people be living in areas like that, and are they defensible? And in some cases, there weren't even fire districts in the neighborhood to fight those fires. You're seeing what's happening here in Southern California, an urban area with rural lands connected as well, and there's a lot of firefighting resources. But when something like this takes off, there's nothing they can do to really get a handle on it. It takes a lot of time.
We're mindful at every point of the people in the middle of this right now, those crowds that are gathered, kind of refugees from the fire at the moment, and have their homes and families very much in mind. But there's a big future here we're looking at as well. Let's take a call from Woodward, Iowa. Danielle is on the line. Hi, Danielle. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm probably going to be right in line agreeing with many of your callers. This is not defensible space, nor do I think we should continue to support people who choose to live in areas that are inappropriate for this kind of development.
But you could say that about, you know, all kinds of areas in the United States. I mean, from east to west and north to south, at least.
Well, ecologically speaking, these areas, the way they function, and I'm surprised no one's called about this, in those chaparral areas, their rainfall and their hot temperatures do not coincide. In my prairie state, we have a flush of rainfall, and then we get hot temperatures that grows our grass. In the chaparral areas, the ecology is that you get rain early, you get a flush of growth, and then you have very high temperatures when there is very limited rainfall. This pattern is going to continue, and I'm expecting the insurance companies are not going to want to support that. I also teach classes in ecological restoration, so we use fire as a management tool. We're very sensitive to fuel loads and relative humidity. And as the cameras scan these areas in the West, I'm looking at completely indefensible space. It puts firefighters at great risk.
Yeah, yeah. You and a lot of other people looking at that right now. Danielle, we see that, and it raises a lot of question marks. Thank you for your call. Let's get one more from Iowa. Burlington, Eric, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
Well, this is nothing new. I mean, we've always allowed people who have a lot of money to build wherever they want to, and I have no problem with that as long as they're willing to pay. You look at the Katrina mess. You look at Florida, Hurricane Andrew. We let these people go right back to build. This is no different in Southern California.
You know, not everybody in Southern California has a lot of money. I'm not sure what you mean there. I guess some of those big houses we see on the mountaintops and on the coast, but there's a lot of ordinary folks losing homes, too.
Well, I'm not, and my sympathies go out to all of them. I think we should bail them all out. But I go back to the flood of 93 we had here in Iowa, where several of my friends who had property along the Mississippi River
yep.
were told, "Hey, what are you building there for? We'll bail you out, but you can't go back and build for it. You'd get to be a mile away from the river now, which is ridiculous. And if you ever go back, you can't get any insurance." And yet, I bet when it's all said and done, you're going to let, because I know the prices in La Jolla and San Diego
sure.
and so forth. And I can tell you that even an average two-bedroom home is $500,000 or more. And you know, this is what it's all about. So you watch. When it's all said and done, these people will be able to go back in there. And that's fine with me, as long as they pay a premium price for their insurance and let them do it. But let's be realistic about it.
Well, we'll see. I mean, whether it's the Florida coast or, you know, the Carolinas, which have had their own hurricanes, or the Gulf Coast or now California, yeah, people want to go home. Let's pull the lens back a little bit here and turn to Tempe, Arizona, and Charles Redmond, director of the Global Institute of Sustainability, professor of natural history and the environment at Arizona State University. Chuck Redmond, thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
Look a little more widely for us at the Sun Belt. I mean, this has been the great growth tier of the United States for years now and is projected to go on being exactly that. Are we hearing something from Mother Nature this week in California that should, and for that matter, in the drought we've seen in your neck of the woods and the drought we're seeing in southeastern United States right now, you know, are we getting a message that this maybe won't or can't be the growth future?
I think we're getting the message. It's the bigger question, as your listeners point out, is whether we're hearing the message. The issue of growth is something that would solve a lot of problems if the world didn't increase in population, but I don't think we're going to see that, so I think we have to look at what to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sun Belt, of course, is an area that's very desirable, Southern California in particular, but Arizona and Georgia and across the South, we're seeing huge immigration, and I think 50% growth over the next 30 years is a conservative estimate. Yet I don't want to slam the door on where people want to live and live their life.
So are we going to be seeing this replayed, you know, every October? I mean, along with the problems you're having there in Arizona and Georgia, Carolinas, you name it?
Well, I think what it means is that we have to have a very serious discussion, and your listeners have hinted at it, and that is we have to talk about can people live everywhere they want, and if they do, does the community, the government, help subsidize this kind of growth? Can we live on the outer shores of North Carolina? Can we live in hurricane-prone areas? Can we live on the edge of wildfires?
Have we begun to have that conversation? Is that a conversation this country's, you know, sort of equipped to have?
It's equipped to have it under proper leadership. I think there is a grassroots interest in it, but there's a grassroots interest in doing whatever we want to do. And I think this is a matter of leadership, and yet I think if we don't see that, we will find ourselves with recurrent problems. I mean, to have a wildfire situation like this every 4 years is unbelievable. This has to be frequent enough that people say, well, it isn't just a coincidence. If we were to have another horrendous hurricane event in the next few years, I think somehow at the leadership level we have to begin to see a reorganization, because if we don't, we're just building in a cost to our civilization that we can't bear.
John Keeley, have you thought about in California how this might happen? You say 50% population growth in the next 30 years. John Keeley says that may be conservative. Is there a way to do it, to have this population growth, but, you know, channel it through zoning and public policy so that it doesn't twist the environment out of control? I don't know. Can you put? Will people end up in high rises, in green fields instead of chaparral and sprawling suburbs? Is there any conversation on how to channel it?
Tom, I believe there are a lot of things we can do to alleviate some of the problem. We're always going to be faced with wildfire threats. One of the things to note historically about fires in California, for example, the Los Angeles Basin, I remember back in the 50s and 60s, there were very big fires, but seldom did they ever burn into communities, even though there was relatively high population densities. The primary reason was that many of these communities in the LA Basin were surrounded by citrus groves, and fires would burn down, and they would hit those green belts, and they would burn out, and they wouldn't burn into the community. As development pressures increase, we took out the citrus and other agricultural activities and replaced them with houses. And now we have the houses adjacent to those dangerous fuels. There are ways that developers could alter their plans. For example, now it is commonplace in a lot of developments in Southern California to focus the development on a golf course and put that golf course in the center to maximize the number of view lots on it. But if we redesign those developments, and there's a good example now in Riverside County of a development that has redesigned its positioning of the golf course to be on the perimeter, largely because the U.S. Forest Service indicated they didn't have the funds to do any clearance of fuels, and they advised them that they ought to redesign their development. They've put the golf course on the outside, and that's likely to have a lot of positive repercussions down the line in terms of preventing fires from spreading into communities. So there are things like that to do. I think all in all, we have to realize that individuals changing their opinion about how to place their homes is probably going to be a very difficult way to change the outcome of these events. I think we need to have, as Chuck indicated, we need to have better state leadership to coordinate community planning and bring it in line with what we know about the potential outcomes of these fires.
Golf courses as fire breaks may work for some. Hard to imagine it working for all with 50% population growth. Ed Joyce, we've just got you for another few seconds. We don't want to forget the human toll here. How about your family, your friends, your community? Is everybody okay? The death toll has been remarkably low.
Yes, and that really came because somebody failed to heed the warning to evacuate, and that's something that fire officials and everyone has stressed over and over and over again. When they tell you to leave, leave. Firefighters don't have the time to really spend that extra energy helping people get out when they should have already gotten out, and unfortunately they've had to do that, and that takes them away from battling the fire. There's been people affected where I work. Just about everybody's been touched in the community one way or the other by the fire, and I should add, the smoke is everywhere in the county.
Ed Joyce, we wish you luck with that. I know we have to let you go. At KPBS, good luck with everything, Ed. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We're talking this hour about giant wildfires in Southern California, the future of the California dream. Here's a high school student in Santa Clarita, California, talking about just how bad it is.
When the fire started, there was a whole bunch of smoke surrounding the house, and it was like the sun was red, so it was almost like apocalyptic.
almost like apocalyptic. That's Southern California, or right on there, north of L.A. But look around the country, 26% of the South, and in Alabama, Tennessee, Georgia, North and South Carolina, now in an exceptional drought. In Rock Springs, South Carolina, they've suspended full dunk baptism because they can't fill the tank. And that's the least of it. Emergencies declared in plenty of places down there. Robin's calling from South Royalton, Vermont. Robin, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I moved from California last January. I went through cancer treatment. I'm a cancer survivor.
Good for you.
So I'm real attuned to kindness and people jumping in when we've got emergencies.
Mm-hmm.
I also lived in Pensacola. I was diagnosed in Pensacola and went through about 9 years of hurricanes down there. And along with what we can do as a country in working on environmental issues, we're such a great country, and I'd love for us to be known globally for how we jump in regards to human suffering. Oh, the train's going to go through South Royalton.
Okay, Robin, we've got that. And let me ask just on that front, and Robin, thank you. John Keeley, what about the support of surrounding states of the federal government this time in this situation in Southern California? To Robin's point, has it been sufficient? Has it been quick enough? Has it been what should be expected?
Well, I think that there's been a tremendous amount of local support. I'm not familiar with the facts on how many outside firefighters have been brought into this area, but certainly in terms of the local community coming together and helping people, there's been a lot of that, although there's tremendous confusion at the present time with about a million people being evacuated.
Must be.
You can imagine.
That's just an amazing number. Gray is calling from Thompson, Connecticut. Hi, Gray. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I don't want to broaden the scope too much, but, it seems that we have similar problems in a lot of parts of the country. We have problems where we try to expand into areas where there's difficulty finding drinkable water, et cetera. And it seems that, really, our entire economy is based on expansion, which not only enables us but encourages us to go into new areas, to find new areas to develop. And I just want to know, at the more local level, how can we address this? How can we even contend with this issue if we are up against, these forces, if we're up against what basically is our daily living?
Yeah, Gray, let us hold that point for just a second because, of course, growth is at the heart of so much of the economy and the way we live indeed. But let's get a call from Savannah, Georgia. Then we'll dive in. Michael in Savannah, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yes, I am calling from Savannah, Georgia, and I moved here to this state from Colorado, and as someone who's familiar with the wars that almost took place between California and Arizona and all the states in the history of the development of water policy in the West, it's amazing to me that currently Lake Lanier, which supplies the water supply for Atlanta, Georgia,
right.
Governor Perdue is currently trying to negotiate with the Army Corps of Engineers to limit the amount of water that they have to drain away to support the river downstream.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is that what fails to be in the headlines a lot is that really this is a war between, I shouldn't say a war, to be dramatic, but this is a very large battle between Alabama, Florida, and Georgia, which has been going on for 50 years. And so my question is the water development going to start being more of an attack used against Endangered Species Act or Navigable Waterways Acts, as opposed to just saying, hey, golf courses X, Y, and Z, should we turn, pull their agricultural water permits and not allow them to water the Atlanta metropolitan area golf course.
Right. Who's going to get that water, whether it's human or golf courses or down the Chattahoochee River there from Lake Lanier, mussels and sturgeon that have had a claim on it by law? Charles Redman, let me turn to you here. First, on this issue of water, in Arizona you're very attuned to it. Now, the Southeast is unusually attuned to it right now, and it has turned into a real kind of tense standoff between states and between sort of human and wildlife claims on water. Is this the future?
I think your caller, Michael, has put his finger on a huge issue. I think this week with the fires in California, it's hard to think about other things. Mm-hmm. But in the near future, freshwater use is going to be as important and restrictive as oil use. And we're already seeing evidence of it. And it's a basic conflict. It's a more local conflict. We don't import our freshwater from another country. But it is regionally imported, and it's a struggle between how much is necessary for the environment, how much is necessary for agriculture, that's our largest user by far, and how much can be devoted to people, their homes and lawns and golf courses. And in fact, in Arizona, that's the key issue. You might not think it, but three-fourths of the freshwater use in the state of Arizona still goes into farming. And so we have to look at it, and this is a world that needs more food, so I'm not saying do away with it. John's suggestion about green belts around new developments, these are interesting but water-hungry needs, but we need to address this issue because freshwater is a huge and growing issue globally, and we can see it even in the United States in a number of places. Phoenix actually is surprisingly well-suited for water just because historically we did have water here and people have learned to live with it in certain ways, but we're up against a wall on this. Here in Southern California, now in the Southeast, that's so amazing.
Well, Chuck, but paint a picture for us. I mean, let's assume that we can get our heads around this, and I could be wrong, but let's just imagine that we can steer toward the best way of handling the growth that everybody seems to assume is inevitable in the Sun Belt. What does a sustainable array of human, you know, inhabitation look like in the next 50 years? Does it have to be markedly different from the suburban sprawl we've seen? What would work here? Is there a kind of basic formula that might be able to take on this enormous? We're supposed to go from 300 to 400 million in this country before you know it, and a lot of that in the South. You know, what are the outlines of how that might be workable?
Well, I think if there's any question that leadership should be discussing at all levels, it should be this question of what will we look like in 10 or 20 years and start on that pathway. It's going to require densification. We are going to have to build closer together just to save energy as well as to save water. As we build closer together, we use less outside water, and mm-hmm. So that's one of the great things to do. But I think we also have to think about just efficiency and quality of life and what are the important aspects. I think a lot of this is behavioral, and then I think a lot of it has to do with some much more serious thinking through the issues. The issue of sustainability is not a simple solution, but it's to think of all the implications of what you do. Something as simple as legislating a growth boundary around a city like Seattle and Portland have done has had some wonderful impacts, but beyond that boundary, it's led to tremendous sprawl. And we have to think through simple solutions to more sophisticated ones that involve technology, changes in behavior, changes in settlement pattern, and real decisions about how we use our scarce resources like water and energy.
Let's hear it from a couple of one-time Californians. First, Kristen in Melrose, Massachusetts. Kristen, you're on the air.
Hi. I was calling because I just kind of want actually to defend Poway and RB a little bit. Because Poway actually is not a new community. It is actually an old railroad community that's been there for over 100 years.
Kristen, can you, for us non-Californians, can you define your terms here? Poway and RB, Rancho Bernardino, these are what, suburbs of?
RB is Rancho Bernardo. It's just what
Bernardo.
What they call it when you
okay.
live there.
Okay, And where are these? Are these near San Diego?
Yes, it's a suburb of San Diego, and Poway and Rancho Bernardo are where two of the major fires are that have had major destruction right now.
And you're sticking up for what? The fact of these towns, the life of these towns.
Well, I'm sticking up because I keep hearing a lot of people saying, you know, all this new construction that's going on and it's this urban sprawl, but actually some of these communities have been here for quite a long time. Rancho Bernardo is a newer community, but they placed it actually between two old communities of Escondido, which is north of San Diego, and Poway, which is just a northern suburb of San Diego. And they actually use the space right up along the lake. And so a lot of people are thinking that this is just urban sprawl that has gone straight up into the mountains, but actually, in fact, it's, you know, people in this area have actually tried to stay really close together, and they don't have really large yards, and they don't have there are some houses that have huge properties, but a lot of the people that live there, you know, don't. And so I think that they're just normal people living in normal communities like anywhere, like most people across America. And so when people say, you know, oh, we've got to stop banking straw, it's actually been there for, you know, quite a while.
Kristen, you remind us. I mean, there is history here, and these are homes. These are people's homes, and that makes us politically very tough, and that will always be a factor. Let's get another call on that theme from Joel in Springfield, Massachusetts. Joel, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
One of the things that I live in Massachusetts now, but I lived for quite a while in Saugus, which is in Santa Clarita. As a matter of fact, I'm wondering if my old home is even still there. What a lot of people don't understand, especially like living out here, is when a house is built out here, you build one house and you finish it. Mm-hmm. When they build out there, they build an entire city overnight. They build 10,000 frames, 10,000 structures, and then the city is right there.
Boom.
And it goes in an area that before had coyotes, and suddenly you have the water coming in, suddenly you have this. These are all people that now drive an hour and a half into work, and they don't think anything of it.
So, Joel, do these fires mean to you or to Californians, do you think that that needs to change, or on we go?
Well, I think the problem is lifestyle. The problem is way of life. I mean, California has always had that wonderful thing of, oh, it's sun, it's beautiful, the weather's great year-round, and they entice people to come there, and you certainly can't blame them. But you can't just move in, open up a city, and add 50,000 people without understanding the ramifications of it. And when you get these Santa Ana winds, which come every October, there's nothing new to it. Couple that with the drought, and it's a matchstick. And people need to understand that when you build a city overnight, literally overnight of 20,000 people, all these things are going to happen. And until you change the understanding of that and understand what's going to happen 5 or 10 years down the road when you move in there, that's what you're going to have to do. And I don't know. I don't have the answer.
But you paint the picture that we're seeing right now on every television screen as well as perhaps a consequence. And, Joel, thanks for that. John Keeley, I mean, what about it? Between the caller asked earlier about the sort of presumption of growth built into our economy depends on it. And Joel points to, you know, a way of life that people want, expect, have moved to have. Kristen calls and defends it, saying, come on, there's history here. With all of that momentum behind development, whether it's in California or you name it, on across that tier and maybe beyond, I mean, is human nature and expectation, you know, could it just take us off a cliff here somehow? Or are you confident we're going to turn a corner on how we deal with development?
Well, the history part of this is interesting because some communities like Poway have been around for a very long time. Mm-hmm. However, Poway was one of the communities that was hit very hard by fires in 1889 due to a Santa Ana wind event, just like what we're seeing today. The difference is Poway was not a very big community in 1889. Today, it's much bigger, and we're seeing much bigger impacts on even older communities. So it's not necessarily just those communities that are new. Older communities have been in these fire-prone environments and haven't been well protected. However, we don't see this sort of fire event on a frequent enough basis, perhaps to recognize what the danger is. This is the event we're seeing now is probably a once in a 100 or more year event.
But you had a huge one 4 years ago, 2003, the Cedar Fire.
Well, it's happening more frequently, and it's due to just the juxtaposition of extreme drought conditions and this coincidence of having multiple droughts separated by just a single year of good rainfall is an unusual weather or climate pattern for Southern California, but it's not an unknown climate pattern. We have had decades of extreme droughts historically, even going back into the paleo records, we've had these events. And we've also had these sorts of impacts on communities. I was struck this morning when I woke up and looked at the headlines and saw a million people evacuated from San Diego County. It reminded me of an ethnographic report of an Indian legend about the time of Columbus where they described all of the native peoples of San Diego County moved out to the desert because of a massive wildfire. So these are events that have been impacting people historically, and they're impacting them even worse today because we have more population growth. Now, the answer to what we need to do, I think a beginning point is a dialogue like the one you've started here today, Tom. The whole question of sustainability needs to be addressed, and we need to recognize that business as usual is not going to solve the problem, and that's perhaps even a perspective we ought to take on the whole question of global population growth. It's assumed that we are going to continue growing, but there are perhaps other perspectives on how we ought to view growth.
Chuck Krebman, what do you think? California's burning. Is this a big enough alarm? Is this going to turn heads and change the national conversation, or are we headed over that? Here we go, Cliff.
Well, just between you and me, I dream that it will, but I don't think that it will. Fortunately, there is sort of a perfect storm of disasters and awakening and the Nobel Prize related to climate change. We could be at a tipping point of interest here. It's my dream, and actually what we work on, and I think probably all the callers are interested in, is opening up that discussion in a serious way. I do recommend Jared Diamond's Collapse book for all your listeners.
Well, the fire is giving us a big wake-up call. Maybe there's a book or two that will help, and a big conversation obviously necessary, and we're very grateful to the two of you for helping us jump into it today. Charles Redman at Arizona State in Tempe, Arizona. Chuck, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And John Keeley in Sacramento, California at the U.S. Geological Survey. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.